microfono. Is held up obviously, we didn't expect him here. But I got a call from the CEO SAPO. Honorable Minister has directed him to come to this meeting, but he said, well, they have some pressing things, including a board meeting, and requested that he and the CEO go attend to the crucial business. I said to them, but I'm not going to step the program that has been appealed upon in advance, and therefore, whomever they will send here will be fine. So, we have two items on our agenda. Oh, I assume that the other apology will be the
final apology.
Yeah. I assume the other member who's not well. She's not well. I don't know whether it's an improvement. But she's been unwell for quite some time. And we tend to pay a visit to her. And if our program, if we find space in our program, I think I'll have to go and pay a visit to her. Well, welcome to everyone. Welcome to each year, team. And, who represents the SAPO then? Thank you. The gentleman that you don't know.
Trevor Nav.
Sorry.
The name is Trevor Nav, Chief Executive Program Strategy.
Oh, you're also with SAPO?
Yes, I'm with SAPO.
Okay.
And our campaign secretary.
Oh, yeah. You know the gentleman. Okay, perfect. I guess we've got people that are relevant, finances, as well as the person who casts that document. Obviously, what we're dealing with today is history, the third and the fourth quarter. Hopefully, by now, they will not have finally concluded the fourth quarter, because the fourth quarter has been subjected. The final outcome of fourth quarter will be determined by the final audit. So what we're really looking at whether the things that you have been to do have been dealt with appropriately, history, we're already dealing with 2019, already approved that picture. So we're just going to the graves and looking at what happened in the past. Teacher, we will have to run our affairs in a much more prudent way. And then hopefully, if we find space, we will want to delve into the field a little bit and see how far we can go. And we requested that we actually don't want any of you. The most important person would be the legal person. If the person is around.
Good morning, Chairperson, all of the members, colleagues, and stakeholders from the industry. We are once again, Chairperson, happy to be here to present the quarter three and quarter four performance results of the department. And we take note of what we've said, that the horse is bolted, in that we are already in the new disposition in terms of the current financial year, but we still take note that we need to account for what actually happened to the performance of the department in the two quarters. Just very quickly, the chairperson. Overall, from my side, I can indicate that our performance stands at 82% as of the end of the last quarter. With the significant expenditure of the department in terms of resources, the CFO will also give us financial issues in terms of how much we have to go in the management of the resources. Very quickly, three areas where we did not achieve are mainly because of interdependencies, which has since been attended to, and that pertains to electronic commerce, the agreement that we're supposed to sign with the Western Coastal Union, but was not signed because we needed to get the input of Mr. Treasurer. And that agreement in force as spending money. There was another agreement that we're supposed to sign with IBM that pertains to Eastgate. Now, if I can say something on this one, what we wanted to do with IBM is to have a platform that allows South Africans from whichever location to be trained online in ICT. Now, as we're negotiating that agreement with IBM, so happened that IBM suggested that we must sign on condition that should young people enter that platform and direct to illicit content, the department will take responsibility. So we have a platform that is open to all South Africans who can use to get that thing. But then the requirement was that should it happen that they accept illicit content, the department would have had to take responsibility. So we could not be obviously agree to that, and we are continuing to work with IBM to resolve the issue. I'm doing this, Chairperson, just to illustrate that there are always those areas that we have targets to meet, but it turns out that there are other interdependencies that are beyond our control. And this obviously is not an issue, but just to illustrate some of the challenges that we come across when we deal with the town of the country. Then there's an issue of broadband, which has been pending for some time, that will not be really met in the target. But we're seeing a tent in the corner in Chairperson in that we have appointed the entities that are implementing. The entities went on a massive procurement drive and invited the industry on board to participate in the rollout of PCA Connect. We've just signed an agreement with the DBSA, the Development Bank of Southern Africa, on financing the PCA Connect. So these three issues were not met, but we have seen a tent. So what we'll do, Chairperson, we'll just take you through a high-level overview of the key silent issues for the two quarters and also deal with the finances. The Chief Director Strategy will lead the presentation on the other end, and the CFO will then deal with the financial issues, and all of us will finish the issue.
Thank you, DG. Honorable Chairperson, honorable members. Unfortunately, we don't have a projector running, so I'll work on the hard copy. Following from the DG's introduction, if we can go then straight to slide three, which looks at the graphical representation of the quarter three performance, the performance overview. So basically, if you look at the window period of 1 October to 31 December 2017, the department set itself 21 annual performance plan targets as set out in the APP across the six branches, of which 16 of them were achieved while 5 were not achieved. That gives us an achievement or a performance of 76% for that period. If we move on to slide 4, the slide basically highlights the significant achievements in relation to that period. One of the first focus was on the development of ICT policies and strategies. In this regard, the department obtained cluster and cabinet committee approval of the ECA, the INSC bill, as well as the Postal Services Amendment bill, which then went on and to cabinet, which can be obtained approval for gazetting. And then the department is currently nearing conclusion on the consultation process following the gazetting of these bills for public consultation. Also, what was significant in this quarter is that the approval lot was obtained of the three strategies, the National E-Strategy, the ICT SME Development Strategy, and the E-Cloud Strategy. And in this financial, we facilitate implementation of these strategies. In terms of the SOC oversight and post-bank, stemming from the SOC rationalization project started in 1617, frameworks for both the state ICT infrastructure company and the state IT company were submitted to cabinet for approval and subsequently approved. And in terms of the post-bank, the department facilitated the development of the product and service offerings and also monitored that the same. These are largely related to the lending strategy, digital banking, etc. In terms of cybersecurity, we developed the quarterly monitoring report, which covers the incidents and the awareness and all of that. And in terms of preparations for WRT 19, we prepared the final preliminary positions report was developed. And this basically is towards our participation in WCNIC, which on the outcome thereof will then inform the review of the rate of payment plan in 1920 financial year. If you go on to slide 5, so it continued with the significant achievement in terms of the SA's ICT agenda on international obligations. We advanced the RSA position at SADC and also developed the outcomes report, as well as we advanced the RSA position to UPU, and also focused on negotiating two partnership frameworks, one with IBM and the other one on with Intel side. In terms of internally focused, the department also did a family and culture survey in 2016 to improve the culture of the department as well as improve service delivery as a whole. In this regard, we achieved 35% of identified interventions. There were 25% of interventions accumulated for every quarter towards 100% of quarter four, so we achieved the intended interventions for quarter three. In terms of slide 6, if we move on, this slide basically focuses on areas of underachievement. The five targets that we didn't achieve, the first one was related to the organizational structure. We should have commenced with migration of staff, but unfortunately the structure had not been finalized as planned. In terms of the BRICS implementation plan, we should have engaged with stakeholders, largely that is NAMISA, as they were identified as the implementing stakeholder. But face-to-face consultations did not take place by the end of quarter three. In terms of the other two bullets, the position paper for WTDC and the position paper for UPU Council, in essence those were achieved, but were reported. We had to report them as not achieved almost on a technicality because based on the monitoring evaluation process, the required evidence to confirm the approval of the positions were actually submitted post the close of the quarter or the reporting period. So on a technicality, we kept it even in this presentation as not achieved, just to tally with the quarterly report of the department. But in essence, it was achieved, but it was a matter of the evidence not being submitted in time. And the last one, again, that DG looked at the broadband project, we did not achieve the connectivity targets for that specific quarter. We move on to slide 7, and I'll just focus on the not achieved targets. As mentioned here, we should have commenced with the migration, but as we envisaged migrating staff into the revised structure, we envisaged that the structure should have been finalized by this time. Unfortunately, the project was delayed largely due to initial challenges related to the finalization of the service delivery model, as well as extended consultations with consultant management, staff, labor, etc. But as we stand, as DG mentioned, we've actually made quite a headway in terms of finalizing the revised structure. It's just a matter of now seeking necessary approvals, including the National Treasury and TPME, and we're targeting the 15th of June so that it can follow implementation in 1920 financial year. If we move on, slide 8, I can skip what's achieved. Slide 9, the issue of the RSA position for the BRICS. As mentioned, yeah, the implementation plan was developed, but what we expected was to engage with stakeholders, being the MISA, and I think largely due to the close of the calendar year, the December holidays and so forth, face-to-face consultations were delayed. But it's the department did catch up in quarter four. There was that consultation. And the MISA considered the need for the inclusion in their ACP, the issue of the BRICS Institute for Future Networks. So the department basically caught up on that. If we move on to slide 10, basically this is the target that it was referring to in terms of the purported evidence was basically submitted post the quarter. So approval of the position was subsequently confirmed and the evidence provided. So in essence, it was achieved. And also to date, we've also done the outcomes report stemming from the participation WTDC, and therefore you'll find that the annual target was achieved by the financial year in this regard. If we move on to slide 11, the very same argument over here in terms of the technically the target was achieved and the evidence was subsequently confirmed, actually the approval was subsequently confirmed based on the evidence provided, and then the status report even for the UP was also developed and signed off, so in essence the annual target has been achieved by end of the financial year. If you move on to past slide 12, which was achieved, slide 13, everything was achieved with regards to the bill, the strategies approved. Slide 14, also strategies were approved by Cabinet as planned, both of them. Slide 15, also the frameworks were done and submitted and approved by Cabinet as planned. Slide 16, the cooperation of the post bank was stated as planned. Slide 17, also the SOC oversight reports were done as planned, the consolidated SOC oversight reports to also do the joint review for performance. And then if we go to slide 18, that's where we look at broadband. As Didier mentioned, we fell short of the target, and Didier already covered in terms of where we are today in terms of the connectivity issues, and the orders have been issued as well and so forth. If we move on to slide 19, that's also achieved, and if I can pause here and hand over to the CFO to cover financials for that period achieved.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Chair and honorable members. The expenditure for quarter three was sitting at 91%, if we look at slide number 21. If we mainly look at the projects that were below the 75% mark, the policy and research capacity and development was sitting at 66%. Mainly because there was less spending under the consultant items because more work was done internally in the department. And again, when we look at infrastructure support, 64% spending, mainly due to the broadband project that was not yet implemented at the end of third quarter. If we look at slide number 22, on the compensation of employees, we are on par at 75% in terms of our spending. And when we look at the goods and services, where the department was sitting at 25%, mainly on the consultant line item, due to the broadband project. As I alluded, it was not yet implemented at the time. And then 93% of the transfers were made at the time, and payment of financial assets, it was 100%, which included the 3.7 billion that was transferred to SAPO, and payment for capital assets, it was sitting at 78% in terms of that. Then the total expenditure was $1.1 million. And then when we look at the transfers, Chair, I'll focus on the foreign government in terms of the membership fees. We've actually transferred 100%. However, there was an overspending due to the foreign exchange variance, which pushed it up to 102% there. And of which in the fourth quarter, that's where they will close the gap. And then in terms of the expenditure, only what was outstanding, it was NEMISA and USASA and USEF, and as well as USEF for the total digital migration, which was 75%. Total 93% of the transfers were made. Thank you, Chair.
But I think I don't know what the views of members are. Should they think quarter four so that we do everything? Quarter four.
Thanks, Chair. In terms of quarter four, it starts on slide 25. Similarly, it covers the window period of January 1 to 31 March, end of the financial year. In this period, the department could achieve 19. Quarterly targets, of which 14 were achieved, while 5 were not achieved, and this gives us a 74% achievement for that period. But however, as mentioned at the bottom of the slide, we also do cumulative reporting against the annual targets. So what you'll find is, as the DG mentioned, at the end of the financial year, of the 17 annual targets that we had to achieve, we achieved 14 of them. That's 82% achievement, and this will also be reflected in our annual report that we are fully finalizing. On slide 26, it just again covers the significant achievements. These largely related to the, in terms of our development of our ICT policies and strategies. So following the cabinet approval for gazetting the three bills, we commence a public consultation, which is nearing conclusion. In terms of the three strategies, we also took a step further and developed implementation plans for these. And then in terms of post-bank corporatization, we developed the year-end report, which covered all post-bank related initiatives that the department undertook. cybersecurity, we continue with the monitoring. We do the quarterly monitoring reports. It was one quarter behind. It was a quarter three report produced. Preparation of WRC 19 went further to have the technical and regulatory studies report developed and approved, including preliminary draft interpositions in preparation for WRC 19. On slide 27, continues in terms of the significant achievements on advancing SSIC agenda and our international obligations. We finalized the implementation plan for the BRICS Institute for Future Networks, and which was considered by NAMISA for inclusion in the 18-19 ACP. We developed the second phase bypass, the RCS status supporting that, as well as developed the outcomes report stemming from WTDC. In terms of internally focused agriculture and climate action plan, we implemented all 100% of the identified interventions as per the climate and agriculture survey action plan, and this actually equated to 29 interventions that we undertook in the 17-18 financial year, and that's just some of the highlights. And we are continuing this in the 18-19 financial year, as it is a three-year implementation plan or three-year action plan. On slide 28, it just covers the areas of underachievement. The first one, again, is a knock-on from the previous quarters, which is the migration of staff. We should have finalized this, but again, the organization structure was not as yet finalized at this point in time. As DG mentioned, this is one of the annual targets, unfortunately, that we will have to report is not achieved in the end of the financial year. In terms of the next two bullets, which is the partnerships for the SME growth and ICT enterprise development and the partnership for SAP or e-commerce SAP, that both of those actually were not achieved. Also, the first one, the IBM, we could not finalize the partnership agreement, and the SAP and UPU, the cooperation agreement, was finalized. Actually, both of these bullets form one annual target, which is on two partnerships should have been secured, one annual APP target, and of course, this is one of the targets we will not have achieved as well by the end of the financial year, as DG mentioned. And the third one that will also not have been achieved by the end of the financial year is the connectivity, the broadband connectivity. But as DG mentioned, we have made quite significant progress in the recent time. And the last one for the quarter that wasn't achieved was the funding options, but that also we made significant efforts in terms of the GDSA agreement. If we move on to slide 29, this just covers in terms of the migration of staff that have been finalized, but again, as we mentioned, it was largely due to consultations and so forth. But in terms of where we are now, we're targeting the 15th June day to have this submitted to Treasury, and that's post the draft structure being approved and so forth. Slide 30, we've achieved the 29 interventions, as I mentioned, equating 100%. Slide 31, repositions were done as planned. Slide 32, we developed the outcome support and the status report as planned. Slide 33, this is where the partnerships that I was referring to, the two partnerships. The first one with IBM, unfortunately, due to prolonged legal scrutiny by both sides, we weren't able to finalize it on slide 33. However, as mentioned by the DG, we already in consultation with IBM, they've actually kicked off with the training itself. In terms of the staff or e-commerce hub with UPU, we're just finalizing the engagement between SAPO and National Treasury and the State Advisor to have that agreement finalized as well. So there has been progress in that regard. But however, the department also made extensive progress in terms of the e-commerce platform for SAPO, from the developing the prototype and now looking forward to rolling it out in the next financial year. On slide 34, the prioritized goals were public consultation comments as planned, and so we also developed the implementation plan for the new strategy. Slide 35, also the implementation plans were finalized as planned. Slide 36, all went according to plan in terms of the corporatization of World Bank as well as the SOC oversight target. Slide 37 will bring us back to the issue of connectivity where we didn't achieve, but albeit we didn't achieve the target. I think as mentioned by the DG as well, the contracts have been signed and we are pushing forward in terms of connectivity as well as this extensive progress made in terms of the rapid deployment coordination center in this regard as well. In terms of funding options, as mentioned also by the DG, we've already signed the DPSA, so there's been progress in that regard. And we have turned the corner there as well. And the last slide for my performance will be 38. Sorry, not my performance department. Will be slide 38. Will be on track and we achieve the registered security hub as well as preparation for WRC 19. Yeah, thank you, Chair. I could again hand over to the CFO.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Church. When we look at slide number 40, the figures indicated there, it is after all the violence and the shifting of funds were done and all were within the 8% limit that is required by the PFMA. And we are happy to also announce that there was no unauthorized expenditure that was picked up during this quarter. In terms of the expenditure, the department was sitting at 95% at the end of the quarter, and also again we receive policy and ICT infrastructure support. That policy is mainly on the consultants, the way the work was done internally, and the infrastructure support also again for the broadband project. But at this stage, there's also an advance of about 4.9 million that was transferred to BBI to commence with the project as, after the appointment of BBI and BBI. When we look at slide number 41, compensation of employees, sitting at 99%, the 1.3 million understanding there was due to the reports that were not filled, and mainly because the structure was not finalized yet. Then in terms of the prison services, also we see mainly on the software project, and there was less usage of consultants, mainly in program 3, and also there was less usage of outsourced services, mainly on the repairs of the conditions that was not done, where we focus on doing global repairs and also the maintenance in the new financial year. And then payments for capital assets was mainly under other machinery, the IT machinery that were not retained on time, and also the software and the internal audit and risk software, which was not procured at the time. So the expenditure is sitting at 95%. Then when you look at the transfers is sitting at 100%, and at the end of the fourth quarter, the 432 which is sitting under the foreign government and international organizations, that we have closed. The variance of 132,000. So it will not show when we present the annual financial statement of the department. Thank you, Chair. And then, Chair, then on the audit outcomes, on slide number 44, when we look at financial year 2016-17, the findings that were reported in the audit report, there were 4, and in the management center we had 22 findings. Overall we had 26 findings, and then we had an unqualified audit opinion. And then I will move on to slide number 45, where we indicate that we have developed the integrated action plan committee, which focuses mainly on all the findings of the department, including the internal audit findings, as well as also MPED. So this committee also focuses, monitors the progress on the findings, and then we also report the progress to the executive management as well as the audit committee. Then slide number 46, Chair. That is the just a summary of all the findings. In total, we had 26 findings, which had in turn had 42 internal controls. And then, if I can also explain on the red, we have 2 findings which were not resolved by the end of the fourth quarter, which is mainly on the sealing of the vault, which were retained for more than 6 months, and also affected by the structure not being finalized, then also we're still having issues in the SCL unit where requests are submitted on a short notice for procurement matters. Then when we look at the yellow 50% implementation, is where under irregular expenditure, the compliance committee was appointed to address the irregular expenditure. It's just this committee needs to start being active, and also a plan is also developed to address the irregular expenditure. And also we have disciplinary processes that's in play, that are in progress, and by the time we reported this, they will not finalize. And then as well, we also have the loss control committee where it was looked at the matter where we needed to recover funds from one ex-official, and the matter was referred to legal services, and we are still awaiting that response from legal services, and the matter was also taken forward to the state attorney. Then we also have findings under annual financial statement disclosure, where we had a meeting with the SOC branch as well as mainly SACO to discuss the information that's needed, how it's needed, and also the verification of the information that we received from the entity. And that will also be determined by the end of the, when we finalize the annual financial statement. And then there's also two which are under not due for implementation. It's mainly on the performance assessment where the monitoring of those, it was will be done in the new financial year, and the report will be presented in the TDC. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Earlier on, when I bring the issue of us moving, I'm going to tell you the apologies. As just indicated to you, here is actually in the chain. She was something that she's doing, and therefore she can only join us if we find a room closer to the minister.
Since that works, it's going to be very close. Maybe Kevin just going to swim for the one vote.
Can I not hear? Thank you for the presentation. Colleague, those are the reports 3 and 4. Any takers? Can take us. So we are fine. Perhaps, is everyone okay? The question that one would want to ask is that, when you go through last page, for instance, the two matters that are not due for implementation, I would want you to actually explain it better, because look, if those things emerge out of the AG's queries, one would naturally expect that you would be in a position to have it attended to and so on. Let me make me and remain on the red. What is likely to happen on a similar matter come 2018-19? But, and perhaps I must comment for adhering to this slide, because this slide came actually from the committee. Because it actually gives you an overall view of how we have moved to deal with simple issues of compliance, because that's what actually we're dealing with, something that, and nobody said to people, keep on it, it's a
I mean, technically 42 here, but it is a 52. It's just to make sure that you put the necessary restriction days and then comply. But the yellow performance, we are hoping that all those items where you have been, where you, your implementation has not reached the required attention by the time, by this time, that we won't have it come next year. Because that's what we expect of yourself, is a clean audit, but it has been a compliance issue. These are the things that you are supposed to be doing anyway. But yeah, basically one response on the yellow, and just an elaboration on the two methods. That, where is the hiccup?
Okay, thank you, Chair. I will start with the two methods under not due for implementation. The two methods relate to the performance samples that were not submitted on time. In fact, the finding from AG was that no corrective measures were taken to support employees whose performance has been assessed as poor, and also performance agreements not submitted within the required time frame. And also SMF members did not complete their quality assurance checking performance agreement. Chair, in terms of the controls, there's two controls which are yellow, where I've indicated that the disciplinary process is in progress, mainly for those officials who did not submit the performance agreement on time, and we still awaiting the final verdict. And then also the letters were also submitted to the relevant supervisors to take disciplinary actions, and some cases are being handled by the employee relations and also HRC is also initiating the integrated action committee on this basis. So in relation to your question, what's likely to happen in 2018-19, unfortunately, Chair, we still have one official who did not submit the performance agreement. Well, the due date is the end of May. However, up to date, HR have done everything to implement controls where we pushed the due dates forward. However, this particular official still does not want to submit the performance agreement.
Who is this official? Do you come out here?
It's Mr. Kabiaka. Yes, the chapter that I can deal with that. It's Mr. Kabiaka, the teacher, who has seen this line. As we're running with the display process.
He went to the bank, because that's all the problem, because you cannot have a situation. Because I was saying, if the department is unable to deal with that person, we'll kindly request him or her to appear before the committee, and we'll do it for you, should it be a problem. Okay, then it's fine. So the matter is not going to be cared, because the person is gone. Actually, everyone who does not comply, surely, we should not be dealing with frivolous issues that are immaterial. I mean, if a person gets appointed in a position, there are certain things that are supposed to be happening by time and there is no movement, surely this issue is not. I know you can't be reckless when you think you're human, because you also have labor relations issues in your debut. Go through certain processes, but surely we must put our foot down. But we will have to, in case there is no movement, we will have to
Thanks, sir. I just want to deal very quickly with the issue of comment, a public comment. What we do in the department, when we sign performance management agreement, we ask people to also indicate areas of where they need help, where they need to be asked. And one of the biggest challenges is that that's done by the individual, saying that I need support in the community. Now what I've done, I asked the manager to give me a report. What causes this lack of performance? Is it a skills issue? Is it a case of subordination, not understanding what you need to be done, and all those kinds of things. And the outcome is bad in terms of what is the issue. There are clearly areas where people are not improving because of the capacity. Now, I went back to look at what were the commitments in terms of the development of the in some areas, I do find a mismatch, where people would like to do exciting things, things that are exciting. While faced with the challenge here, we want to go and do what is exciting. So that is a quality assurance issue, where we're going to now say that as much as it's your choice, we must negotiate your performance development areas and agree to that, because if we just sign based on what people have produced, then we can find this gap in the system. And I think when we present the annual report, one will deal with this issue as well, how we are trying to resolve the mismatch between what people want to do versus their own challenges that are really open for everyone to.
Well, on this one, it's not like an offense. It's not like an offense. It's just a pure incapacity. So if you are incapacitated, I mean, that's my thing. If the question, and I think that what the DG is raising is an important matter. So it means the, for lack of a better word, the best way that has been used to test a person, either as they come in or as they move up, is inadequate. Because whilst individual can tell the areas we need to be mobilized to go to exciting is your battery that you use to test their abilities to get into subsequent positions. To be saying that, well, as the person was growing, these were the areas of lack. Or, and I know that even our certificates don't quite explain what we possess. But for instance, if position X requires this kind of an ability, and a person doesn't have, the person should be able to prove that he has what it takes for position X. If you want to be teaching, you have the strong leadership qualities. You know, the AG has got the AG. It has got those metrics where the level of leadership, for instance, when you are occupying your top pyramid. When you are a DG, your leadership strength should be 80% or 90% and 10% management, or something like that. When you are in the second level, you are 60-40. When you are in a lower level, you are more operational. And the thing changes, your leadership can be less, and then your operation stronger. It is that thing that is being used. I think some of these, but it's fine, let's not belabor the matter. But try and improve on the areas that I'm happy that you've identified the gaps and areas where you will need to intervene and work with the person, do a proper assessment, and help the people out of their situation. Colleagues, are you okay? More. we are going to then move to SAM. This is the only other entity that we've invited as requested by one member. Madam, you're on the floor.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I'm going to do a brief introduction and then hand over to Martin to speak to the members through their presentation. Apologies from our board members. We had a board meeting yesterday, and due to the short notice for this meeting, so to summarize and to give you highlights from the presentation, the operations of the post office have not been stabilized. Although over the fourth quarter, the liquidity issues intensified. We did raise a 400 million rand bridging loan in December 2017, which was used to settle creditors' balances. The 3.7 billion equity injection that the post office received from GTPF in December was used to repay bank loans on the instruction of the shareholder. It's important to note that SAPO is still incurring costs to service its public service mandate. So the Postal Services Act requires that SAPO deliver a service at a fixed fee has to deliver that service regardless of whether it's profitable. So that accounts for 733 million rand worth of our cost base each year. If you then add on 300 million rand for the interest on the loans, given that they were freely repaid, that saves us about 100 million rand. That brings us to a 1 billion rand provisional loss for the year. It's important to note that revenues have stabilized. The costs have been controlled and managed as far as possible. And the year-on-year loss has decreased. Last year it was 1.1 million rand, and our projected loss for the full year is 1 billion rand. Obviously, that still needs to be confirmed by the auditors. We have made good progress in resolving audit issues. For the 2016 financial year, there were 11 qualification areas. For 2017, that was reduced to 3 repeats plus 1 new one, and we are on track to have no qualifications on the financial statements for the 2018 financial year. So there's been a big improvement and a big focus on financial discipline in the business. And that's basically the highlights for the year. Trevor will walk you through the presentation and give more details.
I'd like to preface this presentation by saying that it's been a very difficult as the CFO has indicated, we have begun to experience a crunch in terms of liquidity that has had impact across all four areas of the business, and it will become clearer as we go through today's presentation. If you look at our revenue for quarter three, part of the presentation for quarter three, if you look at our revenue for quarter two, it remains flat from the prior year. We actually have a 29 million rand improvement from the previous year. However, it's not growing at the level that we had budgeted for and that we were anticipating, but also that we needed in order for us to cover the cost that we carry. As CFO has indicated, a large part of the cost comes from the service obligation, which we staff are currently paying for, but we're in discussion with National Treasury for it to be carried by National Treasury as all the states that should be in the case. So our revenue for the quarter was up at 9 million from the previous quarter. However, we have managed to keep our costs under control, but also, again, it has to be stated that part of it has to do with the fact that we have not spent in those areas. And we'll talk about those areas later on in the presentation, primarily in the IT area. The DTT project, which is a national project of great importance, I think it's been touched on in the presentation by the GTPF. That project has been proceeding. Again, it's less than what had been anticipated when it was originally conceived. However, for the quarter, we rolled out just over 500,000. We had 500,000 registrations and rolled out just over 250,000 set-top boxes. to qualify in this appeal. We have had a reduction in our staff cost, a marginal one of 256 employees, which took us from 18,296 by the end of December last year. That has contributed marginally to savings and costs. On the labor front, we continue to be engaged with labor to ensure that we have stability in operations because we've identified this as a critical contributor to customer confidence in doing business with the post office. However, we have reached a deadlock with labor with regards to the increase or the adjustment for the families for the past year and for this year. This is a result, again, we alluded to the liquidity challenges the South West facing, and this has resulted in us not being able to pay increase or pay adjustments to our employees. If you go to page number 3, 420 to 443, we moved out of the Eco Point building in Centurion and moved back to our home premises in Pretoria. This has resulted in a 4 million rand per month cost saving, which should come through in our numbers going forward into the year. The cash, the liquidity constraints that we referred to have begun to impact our delivery standards. We're required to deliver 92%, however, for the quarter, we managed to deliver 86.5, which is down by 5.5 from the target. And we have continued in terms of processing and driving mail through parcels through the Joburg International Center. However, the volumes that have gone through, the increasing volumes, have seen a backlog in the month of December, which comes about usually every year due to the increased Christmas parcels in consumption. If we look at our overall performance in terms of our KPIs, we managed to achieve 35.3 for the quarter, and we'll talk a bit more detail about which areas the performance is in. And with regards to the post plan, which is another critical initiative that is on the go, the DCPS and National Treasury have been engaged in the process of amending legislation to enable the registration of the post plan. The critical issue of the bank controlling company is still also pending. That is sitting with the National Treasury in terms of the way forward of the controlling structure of the post plan. If we look at our financial performance specifically, we posted a loss for the quarter of 267 million, which was an improvement from the previous year loss of 407 million. Revenue, however, performed 588 million below budget, and this is again, as we indicated, one of the key areas where SAP is facing a challenge in terms of getting revenue to grow to meet our cost base. Our expenses, as I indicated earlier, have been tightly controlled, with the result that we underperformed budget by 189 million for the quarter, and 1989 million down on prior year. Again, though, I must emphasize that this is, in some cases, as a result of not spending in certain critical areas, and it's coming, beginning to have an impact on the business. The funding that the CFO referred to that we received from National Treasury, as has been indicated, that funding was used to repay the bank loans, which has had a positive impact on our income statement, and has reduced what we're paying in interest. However, fortunately, a portion of that money was, we had hoped that some of that money would be released to SAPO to use to fund investment and to fund some of the operational funds. That did not materialize, so all of the money was used to repay banks. In terms of where we are on our cash flows, we remain in a constrained position on a month-to-month basis. I think we're losing about 80 million rand. The CFO has already spoken about the term facility that was provided to staff in December, part of which was used to repay our creditors, which are beginning to become a challenge in terms of the number of outstanding creditors. our balance sheet, we currently have assets of 17.2 billion, 3.7 billion of which is from that equity injection that we received from the shareholder. And Postbank still remains healthy with a 5.1 billion of funds, and an asset surplus of 2.6 billion. Slide number 5 just gives an overview of some of the things that we've already spoken about, and I'll just quickly touch on the issue of the loss that we'll anticipate. We anticipate a 104 million rand loss, but we posted a higher loss due to not being able to realize the revenue initiative that we anticipate. I wish to point out, I must point out though, that in terms of where we sit on a year-on-year comparative basis, we're only down revenue 6% from prior. So as the CFO has pointed out, we have stabilized the revenue, although it's at a low base, much lower than what we need to be able to cover our costs. If you look at our annual or our year-to-date performance, we're 3% of revenue lower than the prior year, but we are 30% below what we budgeted. And in terms of our expenditure, 10% below our budget and 1% below our prior year. The net loss, annual net loss position is sitting at just under, or was just under, a billion rand in the first quarter. Again, as I've indicated, a significant percentage of that cost base is the public service mandate that we are starting to pay for. If we look at on slide 7, if we look at our performance for the year, sorry, for the quarter, on each of the areas, as I indicated, we achieved 35.2% of our targeted KPIs. On slide 8, we'll begin to talk about specifically what happened in each of those performance areas. If we look at revenue, we achieved 33% of our targets, 33% of the KPIs, or 56% of our revenue target, coming in at less than 588 million, less than what we had planned. And this is various reasons. A significant part of the reason is that we have not been able to invest in order to realize the revenue, but also the situation with our creditors is beginning to impact our generation, because we basically have to pay the creditors to provide the service, and if we can't provide the service, we can't win the business. In terms of what we're looking to do going forward, there are activities that are underway to protect our revenue with regards to the protected area that SAPO has. So we're engaging with ICASA around what we can do to improve our revenue protection. But also we were looking at the end of the third quarter to continue driving solution selling, to basically move from a position of selling just a product to packaging products together and selling a customer a combination of products that needs a specific need. And also we're looking to invest in certain quick win areas. And we'll talk about how that pans out in future points. In terms of reducing our cost base, we managed to accomplish 33% or 1 out of 3 of those objectives. Being the case, we still though managed to keep our costs under control, and we performed within budget. There are reasons for not actually being able to accelerate the cost saving initiatives as we anticipated. Some of those have to do with our mail processing machines not being functional, which is suppliers to be space, machines operating, which brings down our costs in terms of operating. And we really, at the end of the third quarter, we're looking at carrying on with the initiatives that had been put in place. We had, for example, cut travel quite significantly, suffering colleagues to reduce it to only critical travel. And we also looked at moving people from buildings other than the head office, moving them to our own premises, etc. Those things we're carrying on. Also changing routes to reduce our fuel costs. If you go to page 10,
when we look at operating efficiency. We achieved 3 of our 7 targets, 43% of our 3 targets. As I've indicated before, our lack of funding or our funding constraints is beginning to have an impact on our operations, and this is one of the areas where this becomes evident, in that we're not able to roll out some of the IT initiatives that we anticipated, and these have to be reprioritized and shifted out. But also in terms of oversight visits by area managers, the funding constraints have been that we've had to reduce those oversight visits that we've been anticipating or planning for. If we go to page 10, page 11. One of the challenges that SLAP was faced with is changing the culture of the organization and actually driving it towards being a high performance organization. So that was the intention that we had set ourselves for 2017-18. And in terms of how we've done on that, we've achieved 8% of, I mean, we've achieved 2 out of 8 of our targets. And this largely, again, is where the funding constraints is coming through. It's going to be a recurring narrative as we go into the fourth quarter. And there's an area, however, where it is not a funding constraint, but it is us as staff, where we need to drive discipline. And that is in the area of performance management. For the quarter, third quarter, we had 71% of performance management contract completed. This improved in the fourth quarter, but it's an area that we are driving very hard to make sure that we get that compliance. Now, it's a new culture that has been building and stuff. It was not, I don't know if members will recall, in the 2016-17 year, the number was sitting at about 37%. So we've actually continuously driven this to get managers to understand and start to understand that performance management process is a critical part of management activities. So we see an improvement in that, but we see, however, we've not been able to recruit as we anticipated to recruit, so that resulted in us not meeting some of our targets in terms of becoming a high performance organization. We've not been able to fill some of the positions that we wanted to fill because of the shortage of funds. So we had to prioritize and decide which positions we can hold off and which ones are critical to fill. We'll talk about that again when we look at the fourth quarter. In terms of governance and compliance, we have set a target of clearing critical items, audit items within a certain period. We were not able to accomplish this, and I think when the CFO later on talks about where, and I'd like to give an opportunity to talk about where we have a challenge as an organization in terms of the skills and the systems that we have. I know the chairperson was saying that compliance is a simple matter of just doing it. It's unfortunately much more difficult when you don't have the systems to support you to do it, and if you don't have the skills and the people to actually do it. So this is what we're experiencing as an organization. Our finance function has taken this on and is embarked on a program to work with the business units to help skill them up to be able to actually oversee and manage controls. And I think our CFO can talk a bit more about that after our position as well. This is the end for the Q3 presentation. If we can just go to the Q4 presentation from the chair. As I indicated earlier, the recurring theme of the liquidity challenge comes through as well in the fourth quarter, but we'll talk about that as we go through the slides. Again, our revenue was below what we had expected or what we anticipated, and this has contributed to our current challenges in terms of being able to meet our supplier costs as well as our operating costs. However, in terms of reducing those costs, our headcount again went down to 175 employees for the fourth quarter, which has brought down our staff costs marginally again. But if you add this quarter and the previous quarter's number, you'll see that staff headcount is on a continuous decline, which is good and bad, in that some cases there are some skills that are critical that maybe in the organization or in other areas it is skills that would actually should be needed. If you look at where we were in 2015 when I joined the organization, we had about 24,000 people. And we're now sitting at 18,000. So there has been a significant reduction in staff members over the period. And this is something that we see continuing, but we need to actually reduce those staff numbers more for us to come in line with our revenues. The DTT project is again performing well. If you remember in the previous quarter, we had just over a quarter of a million set-top boxes rolled out. We had increased that number to 306,000. And we had just under 500,000 registrations in the fourth quarter that increased to 684,000. And again, the engagements with National Treasury and the DTTs are carrying on around postbank, and the issue of the BCC remains a big question mark that needs to be resolved. There is some urgency to this matter, which I just want to pause and talk about for a minute, in that we submitted our application to the Reserve Bank for postbank license last year in June. So we have a timing challenge in that we're probably approaching uncharted waters where there hasn't been a response with regards to the controlling company and where this controlling company should sit when the proposed bank's application or application to the Reserve Bank has not proceeded. So we don't know what happens when you reach the end of your application period and the application hasn't progressed. So we will be facing a challenge around that in the coming couple of weeks. And just wanted to flag that to the committee. In terms of SASA, which is as everybody is aware, a very big project for the post office, that is on track. The project is being rolled out and we launched the SASA card a few weeks ago. Overall, in terms of our performance on our KPIs for the quarter, we achieved 34.5% of the targeted KPIs. If you look at our overall performance for the year, that is still at 45.9. Financially, our performance again was not what we would have liked to be. If you look at the fourth quarter, we posted a loss of 32 million versus a target of 193. The revenue missed the target by 193, and thus resulting in the loss that we posted. We experienced a decline of 2% from prior in revenues, which is, if you recall what we indicated for the previous quarter, we had a decline of similar to 2%. So that the revenue is, as I indicated earlier, relatively flat over the quarter. However, we needed it to be significantly higher, and we ended short of being at 29% for this quarter, 30% for the previous quarter of the budget. In terms of cost containment, this continues to be an area where we're performing well, in that we were under budget, and we managed to achieve 280 million rand savings or money expenditure for the quarter. As a group, as the CFO pointed out, we anticipating a loss of 162 million for the year, and that's
1.062 billion.
My apologies.
Please zeros
can make it very big. We would be celebrating. That's 84 million rand less, 84 million rand more than prior year. So again, the loss is also stabilized. I think if you compare where we are now to 2014-15, where we're actually on a downward trend, we have now plateaued, which is positive, however we expect it to be going up as opposed to being on a plateau, which is what we've been on. In terms of the loan facility, we've spoken about that. I won't go into that any further, except to say that that loan that we received at the end of December last year is due at the end of December this year. So we are in the process of trying to raise money to be able to pay for it. Otherwise, it will worsen our cash situation. In terms of overall performance for the quarter, we're sitting at 34.5%, and I'll go into each of the performance areas to highlight where the shortfalls or the shortcomings are. The biggest area of concern is the revenue. We'll perform 510 under budget, 510 million under budget. Although we did achieve 71% of objectives, we still need to generate much more revenue. One of the things that's become very clear for us is that we anticipated that we would be able to regain revenues that we had lost in 2013-14. That has not materialized. If you look at the revenue number consistently, it's about $1 billion that we lost today, and it carries on to $1 billion every year, over and above the public service management cost that we carry of about $700 million. So the revenue target continues not to be met, but we still continue to be performing around 2-3% of prior year revenues. In terms of the efforts to grow or retain revenues, again, it's the solution selling that I've spoken about. It will not show in these numbers, but the commercial teams have been able to sell and bring on new contracts of just over 400 million. But those are not billable at the moment. So the contract for a year or 2 years, they'll come through over the next 2 to 3 years as the contract is being executed. So it's a long sales cycle tied with a constrained financial environment where we're not able to pay suppliers. So when our customers say to us, I'm willing to give you business on condition you can deliver this thing in 7 days, we're not able to do it. So that slows down our ability to win the business. In terms of our cost base, as indicated previously, it's an area where we are performing well. It's difficult to spend more than what you have and we don't have anything. So we are maintaining tight control of our costs, but it's beginning to actually impact the business overall. We are trying to raise money in order to meet our current liquidity shortfalls, but also to extend on critical areas. So we're hoping that, yes, we will stay within the ceiling, expenditure ceiling that we've set, but we're hoping to increase what we need in terms of spending so that we get investments that actually pay off and improve revenues. On our operating efficiencies, on this you will see that we met zero of the six KPIs, and these relate primarily to four areas. The one area is the mail delivery standard, where we performed 88.5%, which is higher than the previous quarter. Interestingly, for the first quarter of 2018-19, we actually managed to get this to near 91%. But for the fourth quarter, it was sitting at 88% due to the financial constraints that we're dealing with. Those have been reprioritized in the first quarter of this year, which resulted in a higher performance, but for the previous quarter, it was sitting at 88.5. I mentioned that the lack of funding was impacting business areas slightly. It's particularly in the IT area, where projects have had to be rescheduled because of a lack of funding. And then in terms of the oversight visits, which was one of the targets that we set that we did not achieve, we had to reduce the spending on travel, which impacted that target. If we can go to the next page. As I mentioned, one of our priorities is to drive the organization towards becoming a performance-focused and performance-driven organization. Training is one of the areas that we were looking at in terms of. We often get complaints when people talk about how they walk into a branch and the service that they receive is not very friendly, very customer-centric, etc. The training initiatives that are underway within the organization that have yielded some fruit. However, because of the limitation of our ability to spend, we've not been able to roll these out as much as what we anticipated. And that has impacted our achievement of that target with regards to that objective. In terms of retention of skills, I mentioned this earlier, we've not been able to retain people, and we've not been able to recruit the kinds of people that we wanted to recruit because we're not able to offer an attractive package, but also we have to reprioritize. In order to attract some skills, for example, we've just hired a new head of supply chain because it's a critical part of the business. That's meant that we have to perform other recruitments in order to get that position filled. So our funding challenge or our funding environment is again clearly coming through in terms of all the other performance areas. We are engaged with the DTPS's assistance to look at raising capital to fund the short term capital constraints. But also on a long term basis, we're looking to raise long term capital. One of the critical things which I personally have sort of been harping on about it when people are tired of hearing me talk about it is the public sector mandate cost. Because that 700 million is something that SAFO is funding, which the National Treasury has acknowledged to say, in fact, that is something that should be funded by government because it's a requirement by law to provide civil services facilities. And we're engaging with the National Treasury to reduce that. I'm hoping that in the next year to 2 years we'll see that cost coming down, which will then improve SAFO's actual liquidity position on a month-on-month and quarter-on-quarter basis. But as it currently stands, our ability to recruit, our ability to attract talent, etc., is constrained by our funding shortfall. At this point, I'd like to give the CFO just an opportunity to talk about what gets done on occasion around supporting the business to improve controls in our operating environment.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. Finance has actually taken a lead in this with the assistance of internal audit to engage with all of the business units in a combined assurance task force to go through the audit issues that are raised by both external and internal audit to resolve. And what we've been doing in finance is an analytic-based approach in terms of looking at and analyzing the transactions that support the audit issues to say what is the root cause of each of those issues and can we fix the control at the root cause instead of just making adjustments or based on the audit sample. So we've implemented a number of new controls manually though because we aren't able to given that our most of our systems focus is on building the SAFO solution at the moment. There is a greater focus on making sure that people do what they're supposed to do each month, that the reconciliations are done, that items are not just dumped into like a clearing account, that you can't just dump or write off items to the P&L. We've lost those capabilities. We have to investigate properly before the write-off can be processed. And all of those come to the P&L. To stop people just trying to hide. So there's been big progress there. In terms of IT systems and processes to support the normal day-to-day operations, I think we're suffering from legacy systems that we implemented many years ago and not necessarily updated or kept up to date and relevant. So SAFO is facing a choice. You can either leapfrog and work with partners, preferably external partners, maybe even technical partners or external minority shareholders in some of the subsidiaries like e-commerce, to leverage off existing systems that have been proved to work rather than from those trying to make something work. And we're not very good at actually implementing. We have to recognize that. We're not very good at implementing stuff ourselves internally. So it would make more sense to engage in physical partnerships for e-commerce, banking, for financial services, for a lot of the other things that we do. We haven't opened the engagement with DTPS and National Treasury about that. We've just seen the framework that Treasury published in terms of partnerships and that framework. So we have to do formal application quit those engagements and identification of possible partners. But it doesn't make sense for SAPO to reinvent all its machines at its own, all of its technology at its own cost. It makes sense to enter into agreements with the system where there are previous industries already, to leapfrog, even if it means giving up a portion of revenues, like in doing it on a revenue share arrangement, or giving up a portion of control of a subsidiary entity, so that we still maintain majority ownership, but the minority shares in the future. So that is needed. We can't do it ourselves.
Thanks for the opportunity. What can be done practically? You know, if on the US space, we have asked SAPO to cost the enterprise. So that when we go to the budget, with that, hoping that there will be an allocation at the end of the year, but that gets different because the president signed at the end of the year. So that's practically what we want to do in the US. With e-commerce, they can indicate that we made some strides, and this is the art of the structuring of SAPO. We'll soon launch a pilot of the e-commerce, and in the new financial year, SAPO will be operating as an e-commerce hub for South Africa, Southern Africa, and we're also talking to East African countries. On strategic partnerships, the DGPS is waiting for some to identify areas that we can leverage based on our partners to get partners. They come to be an economy today because of the agency. Now, on the cost benefit perspective, we need to bring to the attention of the community, as colleagues have done. That it is a challenge. In fact, it's not just about the best control. It's a best. It's a best act that says that only public companies can apply to hold a bank license. Now, we have gone all out to resolve this question to an extent of asking Minister of Business to interpret the company. His interpretation was that the wording in the best act was not intended to discriminate against business partners. Because as matters stand, the Companies Act applies to state-owned companies and public companies equally. It's the same. The only time the Companies Act will not apply to the state-owned entity is when there's an application to the Minister of Trade and Industry. Unless there is a special disability. So Minister David's interpretation was this. The wording was not intended to include state companies. Now we took that letter We took that letter from Minister David to both the red bread in this statute and said that the minister responsible for the companies says that state-owned companies cannot be excluded from holding. Then the reverend said they want to work on the basis of what is in the statute. So we've been asking for this one line on the basis. Now the risk is that our license application may, let me say may, because the reverend may extend another one, may expire, which means that we'll have to go through another set of applications, which is a problem for us. Last year, check in the intervening period, we've been in engagement with SAPO and the Postbank. We say that the Postbank, and I need to mention this here in the community, the Postbank uses the infrastructure of the Postbank. It does not have infrastructure of the SAPO. Now, should the post office collapse, it goes out with the Postbank. with severe implications for the SAFAR economy. So what we're trying to do now is to ask the question, how can the cost benefit invest in the infrastructure? So we are working on some money, but all of the infrastructure is other tools. What do we do in that issue? So what we're trying to figure out, what are the critical areas that we require that we need to cost benefit also to the infrastructure? And that is what we're doing.
Colleagues, that's the presentation to you as well as the attendees.
I'm not so quickly unplugged.
Chairperson, thank you very much.
Yeah.
I always have this mixed emotions when I see something before us, when we hear this. On the one hand, an amazing institution that is so well known and serving right out there in the community, with very few other citizens. On the other hand, one that is underachieving in very important I want to come back to the operational issue. I just want to address the issue that the DJ raised. Every time we get additional information, and it's good that the thinking, I think, makes sense. That post bank cannot piggyback on the post office while it is to be a corporate entity and standalone entity. It is part of something, but it has to develop its own agreement as far as rental, co-rental arrangement with both of us. Just like that. So that is a good measure. The only problem is, I really want to instill this upon you. Why is it the work the acting so late to a crisis? And I really want to put it that, for instance, the whole issue about banking, we know for some time it has been. Why would the minister or the department prepare a one-liner that would be submitted to the system? We could have done it for the government. There's now just one other issue, and that is there's a huge nine amendment to the Bank Act, which is the ring table, and which is affecting many other issues settled by the government, which is not the intention, and that is to go through a long and protracted process. What we want to see is that the immediate obstacles are removed. I want to say, what is the department to expedite this? We've asked the question, and I think that was about 2 to 3 months ago, where it is that we said, what should we as a portfolio committee make possible to make that happen? So I'm really disappointed that we actually know further on that point. You say if the banking license may expire, it will not be considered to expire. It's going to stop the process. So we're back another 8 months process, and in the meantime, Southland is back in the box. How can we approach pressure for more funds if we know there is a solution? I really feel that the board must now get their act together and deliver on that. The second point that I just wanted to refer to, if I look at the percentage of people's achievement on the board, very concerned about looking for instance at operational efficiency. Every time we put that in service,
we don't have money, therefore we can't reform our systems, therefore we can't become more operationally efficient, blah, blah, blah. So, thank you. To leapfrog and to have some other arrangement with the institution to ensure that you have up-to-date systems is a critical matter. And we would have wanted at this stage to have more concrete proposals and firm indication of what is possible and what is not possible. I find it very frustrating that every time there's a new idea, but when we hear next time there's an obstacle that idea cannot be implemented. There must be urgency in measures that are taken, and I don't seem to see the urgency. You can't have zero out of six KPIs managed. You can't have zero. Next one, 2 out of 7 performance-driven organizations overseas. Clearly doesn't look good. 0 out of 2 governance and compliance. Now again, comes back, and then it's an addition to all of that. It is the fact that the organization cannot reward performance because of the financial constraint. You know, performance management, which should be there, cannot be because there's no funding. So it is really, it's just sort of a very sad situation, and somehow supplement is able to take the reins and to really get everybody to perform on a higher level so that we can make our case for performance reward. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. It seems that SOC is caught in this vicious cycle of getting money in, settling creditors, paying creditors, starting your business again, running out of money because you're using 80 million rand a month. The only way you can find that 80 million is not to pay your creditors. So you head back into that situation again. And there doesn't seem to be any way out of it. Just a couple of questions specifically. On your EcoPoint lease, I'm very glad you're out of that. That was, and correct me if I'm wrong, that was the subject of an SIU investigation. Has that investigation been finalized? Have any criminal charges been brought to bear? Have any civil charges been brought to bear on anybody involved in this issue, which I think was common cause, but that was entered into determined biasly in a corrupt fashion. And have any steps been taken to recover any revenue lost because of that? You costed your subsidy, universal subsidy, at around 730 million a year. Again, I wasn't here at the time, but I believe the previous subsidy was between 200 and 300 million rand a year. Why is there this big difference in the costing? Because when the post office was being paid that according to 230 million rand a year subsidy, it was making money. Your 18,296 staff, what is the optimal staff complement you're looking at SOC? Because, I heard you say that there's a move to get rid of staff, and that's always been the case since 2014. That's been part of every strategic turnaround plan has been to contain staff. That optimal staff number, you're talking on the one hand about recruiting staff or finding staff, and then you're also talking about getting rid of staff. So you can just give me a bit more insight into that. In terms of the Banks Act amendments, here's the bad news. If you change any legislation, you've got to have a public participation process. You can't just table it before Parliament without that. It's an important step of the legislative process. So here's the bad news. There isn't going to be any amendment by June. There simply isn't the time. So you are going to have to start that process all over again from scratch. I mean, at what point do you throw your hands up in the air and say, we're done with this? Because clearly there are forces that are working against us. What is your plan B when it comes to this? Do you have one? Then I heard, this is just a question as an aside, I heard from several people there are no stamps. Again, post office. Is this the case? Is it confined to some post office? Why have you generally run out of SAT until you get another non-payment to suppliers? Then in terms of your performance contracts, I presume all your executives have signed performance contracts, certainly at senior levels. Where are you finding the levels of non-compliance? Middle, junior, staff? Can you just give us an idea? If you have that breakdown to hand, I appreciate that. Otherwise, here's your get out of jail free. We can put that in writing if you like. In terms of DTT, we've seen USAF and USASA, for example, saying that their budget will be cut for set-top boxes for this year. So clearly that revenue stream is going to come to an end, because there's going to be nothing this year that we can see in the budget. Have you factored that in for now, and how are you seeing this process unrolling in terms of revenue? Then just two questions. On the SASA project and on the e-commerce hub, in this financial year, the one that we're in, what is the impact on revenue of because you're involved in the SASA project on a hybrid model, you are being involved in it. Just looking at what's happening around CBS, there might be some more opportunities to be there. But you're involved in a hybrid model, you're rolling out a certain amount of grants. What do you see the revenue for this year being from the portion of business that you have? And is that portion profitable for you? So because that is secured revenue. And the same question for your e-commerce hub. What is the revenue likely to be for this financial year, should that be implemented? And I heard the word hope. I think Mr. Trinity used the word hope. So you basically my favorite line from this hope is not a strategy. Just that we hope for this and we hope for that. Your last comment about special partnerships, I've been banging on about this for 4 years, that the private partnerships or special partnerships is the way to go for SAP into the future. So I was very excited to hear that comment out. Thank you, Chief.
One more. So I think on that part, it has been actually taken to things pulling some things out of one's control. And if the process is driving it, one can control it, one can only make it go. And the example is the names of the constitutional process. But the Bank Act is outside of the law. So the GDPR's control has to be built up on Singapore's Bank Act. Or the Bank Act is outside of the law, to my extent. So what can be done, I think, is really engagement at the levels of the committee around expediting this process. Because unfortunately, nothing happens with all these. We're almost at the start. In terms of the list of partnerships, I think that can be provided to the party. The process that we've been engaged in at SAP has been to actually develop a framework within SAP for guiding how it is that SAP wants to engage into partnerships. Because what had happened historically was that I framed a good relationship with a company where I'm in SAPO and they're signing up for another partnership agreement, which has resulted in situations where SAPO has not always been favorably positioned in the agreement, where the revenue split in some cases is 30-60, 30-70 in favor of the other party. So what we're working on is developing a framework that will put agreements not only through the process that EXCO will have signed on, but also actually having a process where the board will actually be able to say yes, we're comfortable with this agreement. So there is work that's been done at national treasury level, but we're making sure that we're aligned so that this is not abused in the interest of forming a partnership with companies. On the question of the eco point lease and what charges have been brought against individuals, unfortunately I'm not able to comment, but I think we can.
We've received a letter from our landlord telling us that she's cancelling the lease and we must move out by the 5th of January and we have 5 weeks to move. So I think it's a threat. There's no future liability. Well, we moved. We went into NCC and our National Post Centre. That's our own property in Pretoria, opposite Tshwane Mail Centre. And then we still received a rental invoice for January, and she sent an invoice for February, and she sent another invoice for March. And I suppose one day she cancelled the lease. Our legal guys then had a look at what she was doing, and she's actually suing the post office for damages, not for the future rental, but for damages to the tune of 140 million. So I've raised that as a contingency in the financial statements, just to be prudent. But we're obviously going to fight that. It's going to be a legal battle.
To the question of charges that we go for, I think it's something that we will follow up on. I don't have the information. Since I wasn't able, I cannot comment, but I do know. I actually don't know.
So
we will come back to the committee with specific what charges we go for against each individual. In terms of the USO costing, the question was why is there a difference? So the previous subsidy that was given to SAP was about 300 million a year. Last one was in 2012. And that was for CapEx. So what was happening is SAPO has been given money to build branches in the rural areas that we're talking about where there is no infrastructure. But there was no provision made for operating those branches. So the subsidy that we prepared for the department to submit to the Treasury is based on the calculation of the ability of the area to support the branch. So we have some areas in the country, for example, where you have a branch where people are surviving on less than 170 rand a day. There is no way that you can sustain branches at an area. the priority of the community is just basically buying food and paying school food. So a post office branch is like very low. When you add up all the costs from all these branches as well as the cost of delivering mail, that's when you get to the So the previous subsidy said go and build branches. What we're talking about now is maintaining and supporting the branches that are actually
now. And in fact, it shouldn't really be called a subsidy because we're delivering the service as an agent for government. So it should really be an agency fee on a commercial basis. So we can determine, and we can go into a commercial type arrangement as opposed to just getting a subsidy, which could be interpreted as a bailout. So we need to apply the principle to this.
In terms of the staff optimal numbers, we've worked out various scenarios where we look at our current revenue. We say, given the revenue, what should the staff number be? And we're talking about a reduction of about 4,000 to 5,000 people in order to meet what you can actually plan out in terms of revenue.
From the 18,000.
From the 18,000. You again raise the point of how does that match with the recruitment? You have a different requirement in terms of skill sets. So if you have somebody who is in the mail business working as a mail operator, that skill set you may have too much of versus the skill set that we require, which is in the IT space, where we need people to build systems to support and combat the fraud, etc. So that's how those two components, we're constantly sort of juxtaposing and looking at how we're getting the role, if we're getting the role of people or the role of the role. In terms of...
Before you move on, I'm just jumping in. With the SAPA contract, what we have actually done is we've increased the number of tenders in our branches to support the SAPA business. And a lot of people in our mail environment who are suitably qualified and need the skills for a tender job have actually been moved into retail. So we've appointed 750 new tenders. There's still another 700 odd that we have to appoint. And most of those were internal hires. So we are looking at, for the new revenue streams, let's redeploy internal resources and upskill and train rather than go outside and recruit. We'll only go outside if, for instance, someone doesn't want to move to a particularly remote location, we'll find that there's someone locally there.
Thank goodness you just talked about the post office.
On the question of the bank and abandonment process and whether we have a plan, unfortunately, this is one of those cases where it's out of our hands. The process in the NSP and the correction is probably the TPC guidance on this. If we are unable to go through the process through the normal channels specified in the Act, and the amendment will require the specified process for changing legislation, and to remember this point about the timeline, then we would have to go back to there is no other way as far as I'm aware. On the question of no stamps, no, we do have stamps. We have our stamp, I don't want to call it our stamp economy, but our colleagues responsible for philately are responsible for coordinating the stamps that we have available, the distribution of the stamps in the different branches. So we do have stamps.
Okay, thank you.
And we just ordered more.
And to the question of where are the areas of non-compliance, I think it's important to contextualize the situation with regards to performance. Up until this past year and the 15 years, the culture of performance management didn't exist in the post office. So it's a new thing that we've brought in to require people to complete performance contracts and to actually stick to them and to actually report and inform what they're doing. So we had at the outset indicated that we expected the process to go a 2-year process to actually get people to understand that they have to do this. It's not optional. So part of the resistance to the vendor's question is not so much resistance from not wanting to do it, purely from practice and things that I just don't feel able to do. So our HR department has put in place systems to support automating the contracting process. This is why at the end of Q4, you saw that there were about 94 communities missing completion versus the prior year. So we are on an upward trend, an improvement trend. But again, it's something that we have to drive from board level, which is being driven, to make sure that people understand we have to do this.
Not an easy question. Okay, immediate overwhelm us, then have this unplugged. For the DTT funds, we still have 400 million that has been allocated by government in a trust account in our financial statements. So for the next year and a half, we're okay. In our MTIF submission that we're about to submit, we have included funding requests for not the current financial year, the next financial year and the year thereafter, and those have been through DTT as and DOD. So for now, we're okay.
And I think the next question is probably also there, because about to SASA revenue.
Yeah.
I think before she addresses it, the SASA project has increased itself from what it originally was expected. So I think that also has to be clear on the
council. Yeah. So, I mean, in terms of the original spec, in order not to wildly distort the financial results, what I've been doing in the budget for next year is I put in net profit for the SASA deal, because if it's 3 billion turnover and 2.7 billion cost, for instance, it completely wildly distorts, and then you can't see the underlying performance. So for next year, we're anticipating between the 240 for the current financial year. The current financial year, we're anticipating to be phasing in up to September, and from October we run it fully. We're anticipating about 170 million rand net profit this year, but that would grow to 250 or even more with the scope increase of having to take over and migrate some of the people who've been paid just in cash in remote locations to a different payment solution. That could actually go up to as much as between 400 and 500 million, but obviously with the scope increase, we're still working on the budget and getting the budget and getting those numbers. So it's just an indicative number. Yeah. But we are saving, and we have it on good authority that we are saving as a treasury billion per annum budget.
And then on the e-commerce revenue, we were expecting revenue to be about 100 million in the first year. But we're anticipating that will grow. The e-commerce growth in the country, in fact on the continent, is about 3% projected to reach about 52 billion in the next year overall. So we have been conservative in our estimation, given that we're looking at two areas of the e-commerce. The one is working with SMEs, who are entrepreneurs in rural areas and townships, etc., where they don't have access to sending their products online. So the post office can actually enable them to actually expand the market that they can reach. The other is to use our infrastructure to provide to existing e-commerce retailers in areas where they can't reach. So if you take your takealot.com, for example, they might want to have a warehouse located in Bulawayo, in Zeeshiba, but it might not make sense for them to do that. But we have infrastructure that can rent out to them, and then be able to build in the charging platform. So we I'm glad to see that the members are agreeing with this. We had a meeting with entrepreneurs last week to make sure that when we doing this with the SMEs, we're not on the one hand, and on the other hand, we're understanding the requirements. And they pointed out that there's a challenge in terms of this approach, which is something that we will work on and we'll report to the committee as well. They indicated that, look, if you give me the ability to distribute through the SASA with small guys, and you also give the large guy to make the same thing that I'm selling, the ability to distribute, is going to kill me. So it's a time attention that we as a service provider and also government have to talk to how do we develop our SMEs without necessarily constricting the growth of other sectors. But that is on the goal. And in terms of the growth, we're looking at reaching the 20% growth target or growth level. But at the moment, we're working on a 5% SME growth to be consistent. On the outstanding rentals, currently we stand at 130,000 in outstanding rentals. We have a schedule that we work with, identifying all of the properties on which we owe, what stage we are in terms of obligation with landlords. So some landlords have sent us letters to notify us that they want to suspend the services unless we pay them. So we're managing this to make sure that it doesn't impact us. That's our key priority for OTTT. In terms of the incentives for performance, other incentives for performance. We're wanting to, again, this is a process, we're wanting to move away from the perception that, especially employees have, that I only need to perform if I can get bonus. To move them towards understanding that if you perform, then your prospects will move up in the organization and are determined by that performance. So you need to deliver on your current job so that you have a better chance of getting your next job, which has not been the case. So there's been a disconnect between what I do in my current role and the role that I'm hoping to get in the future. So if I don't do well here, it doesn't matter to me whether I'm going to get in the future. So we're wanting to re-establish that thing so that people understand that you have to open about the fact that you're there, you're paid for it. It also influences your future prospects in terms of growth in the organization. But to Member Lopez's point, it's a process. So we don't expect that the results will come to you in the long term. But like the changing in performance culture, it's something that will happen over 18 to 24 months. In terms of what can be done with staff, Chair, it's in the period that we've looked at SAPO's history and SAPO's performance, it's become very clear. The fact that SAPO has to deliver on the public service mandate, and yes, that mandate is a finance, is a big contributor towards this cycle where money comes in, pays outstanding creditors, pays salaries, and then disappears, and then you have to repeat the regime. Because you're using revenues to cover something that should actually be covered by a company which is servicing, which is government. The government has said, you shall service all the communities, whether it makes money or not, you shall service it. So the question is, funding that will go along towards addressing breaking this cycle. The other will be to actually address SAPO's operating costs. That will be the next thing of what can be done to change the picture. An area that is critical, which we've seen with other postal operators in the world, is that their governments use their post offices. So we're not just talking about delivering of parcels. We're talking about if you want to get an ID, use that in your contention. If you want to get an ID, you should be able to go to the post office and have the full service delivery process happen in the post office. If you want to engage with government, you should be able to do it at your post office. So that's what they've done to actually make sure that the post offices are on the same level. Because the lesson that's come through from the past 3 years is the private sector will look to the post office to provide services, but will not care whether the post office has infrastructure. Government uses the post office to deliver services and therefore cares about the infrastructure. So there is a symbiotic relationship between government and the post office. Those in our assessment are the key things that can be done going forward to actually change the future of the post office and also correct the finance. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Actually, just on the matter that you ended up with, it reminds me of an engagement I had with one of the HOPs responsible for travel. It's a matter that I cannot customer travel as to how they are hoping to get over the situation at UNICEF. That has to pass off to post office. I think there is a role that the post office can play here to help us out. Think about it. They seem to like you in a way with all your problems. And I think you also have, you know, the support from members because we are wishing SAPO well. It's an important role to play, and they can turn things around. And we are happy with the decision, for example, that was taken by the Cabinet Committee to make sure that you get the SASA thing. And hopefully you can regain your ground confidence from your all public entities and ensure that you distribute all those things that need to be. Talk about school books, talk about all those kind of things. Surely, getting out of the, getting electronic now, we no more be carrying all these things school kids will be using internet and stuff. I think there is an important role that SAPO can achieve to play. And I guess occupying that new space becomes very, very crucial. Does any other member want to make the last comment? Mama? That's it, Mama?
Thank you, Chair. If you could just on set-top boxes, give me an idea of your stock levels. Perhaps you could send us a letter or a report, just per province, the stock levels that you have. That would. Thank you, Chair.
Great.
We have to see all businesses growing and if you continue to all enter and really keep what we have to say. This is all this and it will grow. And we can do a subscribe to the
hub. Perhaps the next time you come to the committee, if you could just give us a small presentation on the e-commerce hub, you know, where that business is coming from, the business model that you put in place, that sort of thing, just to give us some in-depth understanding of your activity. I never realized that that's the kind of money we're talking about, 50 billion for the hub in the region, and your share 5-10% of that makes it very, very important. So I'd appreciate some insight on that. Thank you.
Is there anything that you'd like to respond to or comment on? Make any commitment?
Chair, there was a question to the three about home affairs management. There have been engagements with home affairs. I think where things come unstuck is that there is a commitment, I'll call it a commitment, to use the private vehicle, because the argument is that there has to be a tender process where everyone is invited to participate in one. So staff will be just like any time. The argument that we're putting forward is this is like me saying to my children, wait for my time and my attention, I am very, but you must compete with everything else. So that is the challenge. The commitment that is required is government as a whole to make a decision that says we will support to ensure we can move forward. We will support our institution. SAA needs funding, but we will fund on one hand, but we will use the services on the other because it reduces the funding that we need to put in staff or
we can get
from
ESCOM, etc.
So it's really a policy decision that says government uses its own institution to deliver services and strengthen the infrastructure.
Yes. And I don't think the TFMA and the tender requirements are supposed to completely overrule the Intergovernmental Framework Relations Act, which allows for government organizations to be. However, National Treasury Interesting, in my seems to be that you have to follow so we do need this to be discussed at a policy level, because a lot of state-owned entities are back at this stage. And it's hard to remain competitive if your own parent is not even in the jurisdiction.
In the meantime, we suggested that SAPO should also attend to the issue. We know that the staff of IA makes it very difficult to be NSC compliant. So serious decisions have to be taken. If Treasury says that in terms of the TFMB, SAPO has to complete, and all the other SAPO is currently stuck, then it becomes difficult because pricing plays a very big role. So we are faced with that challenge even when we want to assist. Lastly, Chair, Tanu Chief, let me say that if this committee and the Committee on Finance call us, ourselves and Treasury to account on the cost, we'll be willing to do so if there's a joint sitting of Parliament. Ask of the two committees on this to look at the cost of this. It's a single big issue that if we get by, with a game changer. Recently we are exploring with the Department of Housing. They want to set their own housing. It could be a very big thing. And one of the things that we are considering at the GPS level is to invite to use our own infrastructure. So instead of building a new infrastructure for the housing area, then we are going to do a body of all possible and look at the infrastructure there and ask them to come and call the case and use that infrastructure so that we can all maximize it. So that's one of the issues that we are going to be discussing with the post office, US office of the post office. But on the first one, if we are asked to come and account with treasure, maybe they can explain to the committee, to the two committees, why we can't just effect a one-line amendment to the right side.
Yeah, thank you.
Colleagues, I guess we will see if it is acceptable to our commitment. Find your nice angle, which is that you are using to do our work ourselves. But we'll see. Because of the sympathy we have with SAPO, we'll see whether we can. Unfortunately, we actually almost come to the end of our, should I say, what is called the city? What is the term that we are ending up with in the next week or so? Whatever the term is, and therefore, some term. Yeah, second term, whatever. And perhaps it may be a bit difficult for us to have that kind of engagement, especially in light of the timeline that we will do. But we'll see what possibly happens. This brings us to the end of our engagement with yourselves on this matter. And we were hoping that we will move to another place once we have voted, once that looks like there is no state of voting happening. So we will only move once we are elected that there is going to be a vote and the mayor of this particular place. But it looks like we've covered quite a lot of space. The only thing that is remaining is the bill. So the rest of yourselves, I prefer that you get released so that you can attend to the business and you just leave us alone at the night. And advance upon that some kind of an announcement is going to be. Next week we are supposed to be having a Madam Shinzi. Service is on, madam. Service.
No, that's a surprise. I've been calling this for 2 years.
I know you have raised me. I have done my best. I have approached the chair. We have agreed on it. I've been monitoring it. And boom.
No idea where this program is.
That's why I call it Mrs. Shin's meeting. Because I've always met you. I had you for days when I arrived. It's because what happens is when I insisted that the meeting they then I don't know what happens. I can't talk about it. But apologies, Mrs.
Mom.
I'll join you. Where is the lawyer?
Sir, Madam Chair, we brought it two for the price of one.
Oh, you brought two lawyers?
Oh, okay.
We want you to walk us. Remember, we went through the process of your PowerPoint, which was perfect. We covered a lot of stuff. But we want you to walk us through the life of your document. But I know that you have a 2 minutes to speak. Madam, you can chair. Okay, can we have a 5 minute leg stretch?
I do not.
what was the intention on the goal?
It took you a very small thing. I just looked at your letter as a subject of communication. You spelled Oppenheimer wrong. The address is Oppenheimer, H-E-R-1-E-R. Alright, there's a picture.
It's going to be close.
colleagues, we are kick-starting our process. I know lawyers can be very thorough.
Very expensive.
In what they are doing. I'm going to request them to go slightly faster, not really go through everything, because there are things that are standard in the custom of law. But I guess things that they would like to bring to our attention that are different in the DNA. Spend more time, for instance, you say the board, this board case will be the same as the other boards, the way they are constituted, qualifications, if there's a different one, in this case you mentioned. I'm just saying, you know, that kind of approach is a good thing. Hey, yeah, they look at me with very cold faces.
It's like lawyer.
Am I that best to convince you? Okay. You on the floor, gentlemen and ladies.
Thank you, Chair. So, of course, we also come unprepared in the sense that we've been asked to be here, but we didn't know almost have a presentation or what we'll do. So, we're also thinking on our feet and then trying to assist as we can. We will also try to be as objective as possible in the sense that the content team is obviously not here, and therefore there may be issues that they know that we don't know. And where we ourselves, from a legal perspective, then see something, maybe we might even raise it today. So it's something that committee can consider, honourable members can consider further as the process unfolds. So the first two sections are really just about the establishment of the of INEESI. So typically section 2 deals with that and start off by saying it's a juristic person. Now, in the previous committee meeting, the question immediately came, so does the Companies Act apply? And we say it does not, because nowhere in this legislation do we create INEESI as a form of a company or registered as a company and so on. So in principle, for the definitions of the Companies Act, it's not a company, and therefore the Companies Act doesn't apply. So your primary source of governance provisions would therefore at all times be this legislation, and hence it's important to ensure that we cover the important parts. What's interesting later is that a lot of these governance laws, we often copy and paste a lot of things from other laws like the PFMA, and then it becomes confusing because then we start contradicting different laws and so on. And in this law, at least it's reasonably clean in that respect, because it says PFMA applies and this and that section applies, instead of trying to repeat some of those reporting things on the annual report and the financials and so on. In any event, to carry on, section 2, after it establishes it as a juristic person, then it talks about the integration, because we have the MISA and the ESI and ISA at the moment, and those three call it bodies then come together into this one new entity. It states that the PFMA would apply to it, and that it would be listed as a public entity in terms of the PFMA. So it doesn't say what kind of public entity it would be, but later in the bill it then takes it a little bit further and says it would be a national public entity, which by implication means it will be listed under Schedule 3 of the PFMA. But that's an exercise that then follows under the PFMA through the National Treasury process. Then if we turn to Clause 3, so Clause 3 is then, the heading says objects of INEESI, but it starts by saying the purpose of this act is to establish INEESI. Perhaps those two things can be aligned better. But the bottom line is it's a clause that then says what is the mandate of this new entity that's being established. And typically the words we find are words like it's a catalytic collaborator, and it's a change agent, and it collaborates with the post-school education and training institutions, and it encourages and promotes innovative research networks and digital skills. So that in a nutshell then gives really what's the mandate of this entity. Then clause 4 is more specific, because then it says, right, in order to achieve your mandate, what functions do you need to perform? Because you're not a university as such, so what is it that you do and you would be doing? So INESI must promote and guide the development of digital skills and multimedia, identify the skills and media, multimedia demands and supply needs, regularly monitor and advise government and the industry, work with the relevant government departments, institutions and entities to ensure that education and training respond to the demands and needs, raise awareness, and here from a legal perspective, I then start seeing the use of the word ICT, and then in the next sentence, ICT, and I want to ask, if we started defining digital skills, we added multimedia, now we're at ICT skills, which is a little bit wider, so can this be constant, perhaps, as ask ourselves through the document, through the bill, what is exactly anticipated, and is this ICT skill here the same as digital skills as defined? Support initiatives and promote increased use and knowledge of ICTs. Collaborate with the post-school institutions, facilitate research and innovative networks, and then M&E on the level of digital skills and multimedia capability. Then it says what can it then do to achieve its objectives? INESI may, noting that in 4.1 it must, so those are the must do's, and then now follows the may do's. Promote the digital skills framework and training and development model. And as a lawyer, what comes to mind is what is that digital skills framework and training and development model? And is it defined? And perhaps we should just, honorable members should just think about, consider that element. Collaborate with local and international stakeholders to enhance employment and enterprise development opportunities. And then promote digital skills and multimedia teaching, learning, research, innovation, monitoring, evaluation. Here we see ICT, information, skills, and knowledge. Then again, in sub-clause 3, it's something they must do. In other words, they must comply with all the relevant legislation in the education space. They're not deemed to be anything like a higher education institution. They are subordinate to any laws that require them to be registered and get accreditation and so on. And here the Department of Higher Education played a critical role in making sure that this law would not trump their environment, and our nation would still be compliant with our legislative framework. And 2, interact and foster collaboration with the minister responsible for higher education and training. So that ensures synergy with the education sector and that particular ministry. Then, turning to 5, clause 5 is about the co-labs. So the co-labs are labs that are formed usually part of universities where the actual training then takes place and MOUs are entered into between INESI and the post-school education and training institutions. And that's really what this whole clause is about. It says that INESI must enter into such agreements with the universities and must agree on the appropriate terms and conditions for collaboration with each of these institutions. That the co-labs must firstly be accessible to all stakeholders, so it shouldn't be a closed group, provide feedback to INESI in the development of digital skills, and promote and undertake research and innovation, provide research capacity to postgraduate students, initiate and implement projects, which are linked to all those themes we saw in the presentation the previous round, and then establish ICT networks across post-school education and training institutions, other government organizations, civil society, and the business sector. That's part of the ESI's role as well as a collaborator and integrator through the collabs, then achieve this. Lastly, clause sub 4 says, subject to the National Qualifications Framework Act, the collabs may, in collaboration with the appropriate quality council and qualification authority, develop short courses. And then it lists a number of skill areas there. And that's where, in my mind, as a lawyer, again, I say digital skills, multimedia, we said ICT, and now we say internet, cybersecurity, online. And we should just make sure that there's some alignment and synergy in the terminology used. Then, Chair, you spoke about standards. That now we're moving closer to more standard provisions. Of course, now any governance law would require the establishment of boards and appointment procedures and disqualification and removal procedures, and in turn the establishment of or the appointment of the executives of the board, the CEO and CFO and so on. And similarly, how what they are responsible for and how they can be removed if necessary, and then in turn choose to staff complement, and then the governance law will talk about financial issues, how is it funded, and so on. So if we go through that, clause 6, then start by establishing and appointing a board, and it says, I think there was a question like that before. So in sub 2 it says the board is responsible for managing the affairs of INEC. And I think later in the same clause it then says the CEO is responsible, in fact it's sub clause 9. The board has the fiduciary duties and must hold the executives accountable for the day-to-day management of the affairs of the nation. So at the top you have the board. The board is overall responsible for managing the affairs of INEC. The board carries the fiduciary duties of the organization. And then they must make sure that the executive, the CEO and CFO, that they do the day-to-day management of the affairs of INEC. The sub-6, subsection 3, it talks about the constituency of the board itself and how many board members there would be. So you have a board that consists of non-executive and executive members. You have the chairperson, the deputy chairperson, and then a number of between 6 and 10 additional non-executive members. And then you have the two executives, the CFO and the COO. Round clause 5, or clause 6, subsection 5, it then turns to how are the board members appointed. Specifically the non-executive side of the board, and it says the minister must publish a notice in the Gazette and invite nominations for such positions. At the same time, the minister must appoint the independent panel. There will really be a panel that now does the shortlisting of all these nominations that are received. Then it says if the minister receives no nominations, or not enough nominations, the minister may, after consultation with the panel, so the independent panel, re-advertise or in any other transparent manner appoint the required number of qualified persons. We explained last time that it's really a practical arrangement to get the board appointed, provided in an open and transparent way. It then lists a few of the areas that must be represented on the board in terms of knowledge and experience in ICT, academia, research, IT innovation, IT management, law, digital skills and multimedia, intellectual property and commercialization thereof. And the department also
responded in the previous committee meeting that that maybe is also linked to the number of board members and why it appears to be a large board, because of all these critical skills that are required on this particular board. And lastly, it says that if the above process fails, the minister may direct that any alternative process of procuring these skills be initiated. Chairperson, then in clause 7, it now talks about the tenure, the term of office of the members of the board. Generally speaking, they hold office for 3 years and can be reappointed for one term. They can't serve more than 2 terms consecutively. And then that the minister may fill a gap if someone resigns or are removed earlier. And it says after consultation with the board, the minister may extend the term of office of any or all of the members of the board for a period of not more than 6 months or until a new board has been appointed, whichever comes first. Okay. So that's the part that deals with a situation where you don't have a board anymore for whichever reason, and then you may extend the term of office of your members beyond the listed 3 years, or even the listed 2 terms of 3 years in order to get a new board in place. Then Chair, Clause 8 is about disqualification of board members and the process of removal from office. And this is typically what we find in all legislation of this nature, that board members may not be mentally ill, convicted of an offence, and sentenced to imprisonment without the option of a fine, elected as a member of the National Assembly or a provincial legislature, not a South African citizen, removed from a position of trust by a competent court of law, or an unrehabilitated insolvent. Then it says, in which circumstances, so that, those are immediate disqualification criteria. Then, if certain things happen, the minister may, after discussing it with the board, remove a member of the board. In instances of sub 2A, says misconduct, inability to perform the duties of his or her office efficiently, absence from 3 consecutive meetings, or any other reasonable ground. Then it says that if there's now suddenly a vacancy on the board, in these circumstances, the minister can go back to that short list of candidates initially proposed by the independent panel, and from that short list appoint a person in that member's place for the remaining part of the term of office. There's a risk in this kind of clause, because you would just hope that list is still relevant, and it would have its shortcomings, because 5 of the people on the list may not be available anymore, have other occupations or jobs now, and so on. But it's a best attempt to fill the gap. If that doesn't work, then obviously the minister will have to start fresh with readvertisement and so on. The member of the board ceases to hold office if he or she is disqualified as on one of these grounds in subsection 1, or tenders his or her resignation to the minister as the minister accepts. The next clause is clause 9, disclosure of interest. So, generally speaking, boards must function where nothing prevents a member of a board from being able to exercise his or her discretion openly and fairly due to some interest, whether it's financial or otherwise. And the intention of these clauses are usually to make sure that there's always that disclosure, so that a determination can be made whether such a person is fit to be a board member and or fit to participate in a particular meeting, so that all meetings are
take place in good faith and correctly. So firstly, it says a member of the board must, upon appointment, disclose to the minister and annually by way of a written statement any interest, including all financial interests, which could reasonably compromise the board in the performance of its functions. So when appointed, and then every year, such a board member must disclose interests. And then it says a member of the board may not vote or in any manner be present during or participate in the proceedings at any meeting of the board in relation to any matter before the board if he or she has an interest which precludes him or her from performing his or her functions in a fair, unbiased and proper manner. I think we've seen it in previous instances in boards and even councils. Clause 10 is about the remuneration of the board members, and it says that they will receive such remuneration and allowances as the minister may determine, but here the Minister of Finance must also agree on what that remuneration is. Then the meetings of the board, and I know the Honourable Committee will want to look at the curtailing the number of meetings in case some boards get out of hand with the number of meetings they hold. But so we have to test whether these provisions have the mechanisms built in for that. Firstly, the chair presides at the board meetings. If neither the chair or the deputy chair are present, then the rest of the board can nominate someone else to chair the particular meeting. They must meet at least 4 times a year and determine their procedure for meetings. Then there's the power that the chairperson has firstly to convene a special meeting if required, but the board themselves also have a similar power, because if at least 2/3 of the members request a special meeting, then the chair must allow for a special meeting. The next thing, when you deal with boards, you want to deal with what is the quorum of the board and what is the voting arrangement. So in this case, there are no hard and fast rules. We see in different legislation that there are different figures for the quorum and for the voting, but in this particular law we're suggesting a quorum would be 2/3 of the members eligible to vote at that meeting. And then once you form your quorum, a decision of the board must be taken by a resolution of the majority of the board members present at the meeting, where the chairperson usually has a casting vote. So we then turn to the dissolution of the board. Again, the minister may dissolve the board on certain grounds, which are listed there in clause 12.1a and b. But when it comes to the board, the minister is subject to the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act and must follow the procedures set out there. It's really the hearing the other side. I'll be able to impart them. You can't just wake up and remove a board member or a chairperson. You have to obviously follow due process. In contrast, when we get to the CEO, the Labor Relations Act deals with that, those circumstances and procedures to follow. Then it deals with if the board is now removed, the minister must within 21 days appoint an interim board, and the new board must be appointed at least within 180 days of the dissolution of the previous board. Members of a dissolved board may still be reappointed as part of a new board, and the minister must within 30 days of the dissolution of the board submit a report to the National Assembly setting out the reasons for the dissolution of the board. So, Chair, that's then the executives, the non-executives. Now we turn to the executive board members. And usually they are appointed by the board, but with the approval of the minister. And that's what clause 13.1 would do. It said the board must, with the approval of the minister, appoint the CEO and CFO. The board must
and then it talks about the process the board must follow in doing that, inviting applications in the media, and then it says that the CEO and CFO must have the qualification and experience relevant to the functions of INESI, and similarly don't carry any of those qualifications in source 8 above, be paid allowances and remuneration as the board determines, but with the approval of the minister, and those must be consistent with that paid in the public sector. Then the procedure for terminating CEO and CFO appointments. The minister's approval is required for that. But the board may, subject to compliance of the Labour Relations Act, terminate employment of the executive board members on the grounds of misconduct and failing to perform their duties diligently. There's a provision for suspension of services of CEO and CFO while such proceedings are underway. And very importantly, what our governance laws nowadays include is a provision that says when you're suspended as a CEO or CFO, you're similarly suspended as a board member, because in the past, despite such suspensions, the suspended CEO would still insist on attending a board meeting. Then clause 14, sub 3, the CEO or CFO must vacate his or her office if he or she becomes disqualified, as contemplated in Section 8. In here, we have to make provision for acting positions in case there's a vacancy or a problem with the CEO or CFO, and that's what clause 15 does, providing that the board may appoint a senior employee of INESI to act as CEO or CFO, and it lists the circumstances when that can happen. And it says an acting CEO or CFO may exercise all the powers and perform all the duties that the CEO or CFO may ordinarily perform. Then we have to look at the employees of INESI, and we do that in clause 16, and say that that's the responsibility of the CEO, that he or she must consult with the board on the terms and conditions, but the CEO appoints the employees of INESI, and must pay such employees the remuneration and allowances consistent with that in the public sector. The CEO is responsible for the administrative control, organization, and discipline of the employees of INESI. Okay, Chair, thanks. Now we have a board, and we have the executive members, and we have the staff, and then we have to, after we've done the mandate and functions of INESI, now we have to turn to the funding of INESI. Chair, then provides a combination of funding mechanisms. First, the standard money appropriated by Parliament, but also revenue including interest derived from investments and donations and contributions. It says that all income and property and all the proceeds of INESI must be applied to promote these objects, and if the Minister so approves, INESI may invest any of its funds not immediately required. In Chair, it's clause 18 that deals with the annual report, and here, as I said, it's in some of our laws we've previously given specific year and repeated some of the provisions in the PFMA, for example, and then later found that we are contradicting the PFMA, and then all these interpretation issues kick in. So that's what this clause does better, I think. And says in sub-clause 3, for example, the financial management of INESI and the submission of financial statements and annual reports must comply with the provisions of the Public Finance Management Act. So that means we just look at section 54 of the PFMA, and we then know the financial statements and annual reports must be submitted to the AG and Treasury within 5 months of the end of the financial year, and we know that it must be submitted to Parliament via the executive authority being the minister.
Clause 19 just restates that Indonesia must comply with the Public Finance Management Act, and specifically as a national public entity. That then gives us the hint that there will be a Schedule 3 entity. And it just states, it states a bit of the obvious, but it says the board is then the accounting authority, the minister is the executive authority, as contemplated in those mentioned sections of the BFMA. Then most laws have this general provision on general regulatory power given to the minister, which just says the minister may make regulations with regard to any matter incidental to this act. These sections are very seldom used in practice from my experience, but it remains necessary in terms of any legislative framework. Chair, then some last clause on transitional arrangement, because you have these three different entities, and if the separate entities have staff and assets and liabilities and staff have rights and pensions and things, you have to just see if you put all of this together now, what are the implications. Typically, transfer of employees must be subject to the Labor Relations Act. Employees shouldn't have be in a worse position than they are, so their existing rights and privileges must be protected in any such a transition. It typically has provisions that says if there's a pending disciplinary procedure against an official, then it doesn't go away, that it follows into the merged entity where the matter must still be disposed of. And that's kind of things that Clause 21 then deals with. And it ends by calling this act the Nkamba National Dispute Institute Act. And it says that different sections of this law may then be put into operation by the President by proclamation in the Gazette. Usually those sections, that kind of a short title is often used when some preparatory work must first be done. So the alternative is just to say this act is called the INESI Act, which means the day the President signs it, it becomes law, if gazetted. But in some instances, some preparation must take place, some draft regulations must be done, some negotiations with organized labor before transfers can take place. So you allow that preparation to take place, and then through the legal instruments you advise the President, we are now ready to commence with this law. Mr. President, please sign this proclamation, and then only is it proclaimed, and does the relevant sections commence. And that's kind of short title reference to this particular law. And Chair, that's it from me. Thank you, Chair.
Colleagues, lady, off and sweat. We will see if the lawyers can agree. They say if they ever do agree, one of them will not apply to my or get my vote. You are the problem.
Thank you, sir.
Don't follow that one.
My name is Jim Menelemi, I'm a parliamentary leader as well. Sir, for me, I just have some thinking of clarities, which I'm hoping the department can provide some direction to the department to pick up from the members of the bill itself. The first one, just to think, relates to whether the socio-economic regulatory assistance are undertaken for the purposes of this law, as well as whether they align with Section 195(1)(e) and (e) of the Constitution specifically. But I also see in Section 21(8) they make reference to the policy. So I wanted to know whether there was already an established policy that sticks to that speaks to the establishment of these entities, and whether there was compliance there in respect of Section 195(1)(e) and (e) of the Constitution, which are the two provisions that basically speak to the promotion of the development-oriented public administration, as well as the assessment of people's needs, and then responding thereof to as well as to encourage public participation in policy making. The third one, Jefferson, which provided an answer was seek clarity if it's a public entity and what should be informed under, but we've already been given an answer that it's a PA, it should be a public entity, which makes it a national public entity body. Then, Jefferson, the fourth one relates to tagging, just for me to make a point there that from our perspective as legal services here in Parliament and the legal view we hold, is that looking at the content of the bill, it does speak to some extent to the educational issue. But because Section 4 of the Constitution has made the exclusion that when it relates to tertiary education, it's then excluded from being a Section 4 matter. And in that instance, then this bill has, in terms of our view and the legal opinion we've given to the JTF, we are actually in agreement with the department and the state or advisors that it is indeed a Section 75 bill. And then the last two chapters in it relates to just an understanding in terms of the drafting and grammar chapters in as to what in from 6-8 of the bill is meant by the term socioeconomic profile. I think it relates to it relates to the appointment of the board, and then the things there the people must have perspective and a socioeconomic profile. I'm a bit lost there. Then the last one is again considering what is said in from 13, 14, 15 and 16, read 21, whether the employees as well as the executives of this entity will they be subjected to the Public Service Act or not? Those are just my legal clarifications, which I did not pick up from the memo as well as out of the content of the bill itself.
Thank you.
Before I come to you for this, I just want them to raise the issues. Linda, do you want to say something?
Confused. What has happened yet?
Huh?